This is Beyond the Pass, conversations with people from all walks of hospitality life. Centering mental health, Beyond the Pass is a conversation about life, hospitality, and what makes us get out of bed each day. Beyond the Pass is brought to you by Kelly's Cause, and the conversational digressions are brought to you by me, your host, Rachel Kerlapsley. If you can take a minute to like, rate, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, that would be very much appreciated. Without listeners like yourselves, we couldn't keep having these brilliant conversations. Enjoy the episode and keep taking care of each other.
Welcome back to Beyond the Pass. We are kicking off season 4 with the fabulous Paul Spencer. Paul started life in a kitchen in the French suburbs, and over the next 35 years, he fed and developed his passion for hospitality. After years in a global hotel company, it was time to find a role that actually made a difference to an industry he loves. Fast forward to his current role as the Chief Operating Officer for Eaton. Paul is a force for good in hospitality, showing up as the role model we need and a guide for creating more mentally healthy ways to operate in this industry. We are delighted to have him here with us. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, I don't know what to say after that. I feel a bit bashful. I feel like, what? And I'm also 35 years. I turned 50 this year. This was the year I turned 50. And it's one of my friends said to me, you're entering the third phase. Is there
what
a fourth?
I don't know.
I didn't question it. I was like, okay.
Oh my God. I bet the fourth phase is death.
What? This is how we're starting? Apparently third phase is like, you know, you sort of find yourself and you come into your own. So yeah, it's kind of the vibe. So yeah. For 35
all right,
years,
well, here you are.
I know.
Phase 3. Welcome. I like it.
It's a real pleasure to be here. Honestly, like a genuine privilege.
Let's start with your start. So you started in a kitchen in the French suburbs. Paint me a picture. Why were you there and what were you doing?
I didn't really like school. I think that's where, if I'm super honest with you, that's where it was. I've got a healthy disdain for authority, which has continued throughout my whole career. But as a young boy, I didn't really get it. I didn't like learning in the classroom. I didn't like being told what I was going to learn. And I've got nothing, zero. I've got no qualifications. I've got nothing to my name at all. I've got 706 1 and 2, which means I don't cut my fingers off as a chef. You know, that was the only, and just as proof that they're all still here. But yeah, that's where it started for me, actually, was realizing that I was a practical learner and realizing that I wanted to do practical things and realizing that, you know, what I was finding in the classroom or the school wasn't for me. So yeah, it started there. And then I found a passion for cookery. The real honest truth is I really wanted to be an air steward. Honestly, that was the vibe. My godfather, Dave, was an air steward for British Airways in first class. And I always think, oh, this dude looks so cool in this suit. He's just back from Sydney. He's just back from there. So I was like, yo, that is going to be my bag. Of course, you need to speak a language. Didn't speak a language. Well, I spoke English, barely. But I went to one of these career days and they were like, oh, yeah, cool. That'd be really good. How tall are you? And I'm just over 6'3". And weirdly, I've got a son who's 20 years old, who's taller than me now, which is, imagine bollocking a kid upwards. It's really bad. And they were like, well, you're a fire hazard. Like, you're a problem. We can't give you a job. Like, if you run out the plane, knock yourself out, that's the door blocked. So all my aspirations very young were taken. And the only other thing that I really wanted to do was cook. And, you know, at that time, where do you go to learn to cook? I did a little bit of South Downs College. And then I went to France and just learned, just cooked, just figured it out. Didn't speak French, obviously. I spoke kitchen French. I didn't really speak anything. I just went to try and figure it out and figure out who I was as well. And as a young boy, that's really difficult. So mum and dad found me a host family. You know, they wanted some control over what I was up to. And they were lovely. I actually learned loads of cookery from the dad of the host family, who used to cook on an open fire every night, like in their house. Real buzzy, really buzzy. But yeah, I think that's where the love came from. And, you know, over those formative years for me as a young man, I met my family in that kitchen, my brothers and sisters. I met friends that I've still got today, like lifers, because it's kind of like a shared trauma, isn't it? Cookery in some sort of ways.
Totally. We're totally trauma bonded.
Service is a trauma bond. And You know, I as a boy that never found this place, as a boy that, you know, didn't really find this place at school, was shit at sports, was too tall and lanky to do anything else. I should have gone into basketball now, thinking about it. I'm actually going to make some money out of that. But I suddenly found where I belonged, and I belong behind the puff.
And did you know, sort of, as soon as you got into that kitchen, this is my career, this is where I meant to be? Or was it a little trial and error?
It wasn't a career. That's not what I was looking for. Mm. I was looking for a place.
Did that serve you?
Yeah, I think we're all a little bit lost, all of us. And, you know, I don't profess, I'm in my third phase, apparently. I don't profess to be found right now, but we're all a little bit lost, and we're all trying to figure it out. And I don't think I've ever thought of what I do as my career, because I don't see a difference between the pool I am at home and the pool I am at work in any way, shape or form. So, no, I don't think I've found my career. I think I've found my place. I think I found my people, actually. I found people that didn't judge that I wasn't very good at reading and writing. I found people that didn't judge that I didn't speak three languages or was crap at football or was any of those things. I found a community of people that, you know, were trauma bonded together through service. We laughed at the most inappropriate things, and I still do. You know, I feel like I'm in an episode of The Office most times. And actually, what happened, and the job that I now do, which was my dream, I do my dream job now, that was because I found something I wanted to do. I found a place, and I never really considered it to be, it's stupid to say it, and it sounds futile, but I'd never considered this to be the career. I considered this to be me.
It's also really interesting that sort of glamour and the traveling and the jet setting to and fro and the hotels and these things that your godfather did, and you were like, oh, that's sick, that you managed to create a version of that for yourself. Because there's some little boy who's like, oh my God, my cousin Paul, man, he's in Vienna and then he's in Lisbon and he's traveling. Yep. And he's slick and he's got a cool t-shirt. Like, you're now that guy, you know? Yeah. It's amazing how you found your way there.
I think, you know, we know deep down where our heart belongs a lot of the time. And I think you've got a choice, haven't you? You go and work for KPMG and realize that you don't have a heart, or you find a job that gives you soul and joy and something more than that. And not all of my hospitality career has been soulful in any way, shape or form. The whole reason that Eden's been created was to do that. But actually I'd always wanted to feel part of something, and feeling part of something meant I brought to life the job that I wanted. I mean, look, let's be really honest with each other. That came at a cost. It came at two failed marriages. You know, I've got two kids from two different women from two different marriages. It cost me a lot because I put so much into this that, you know, Jack and Charlie, my two boys, 20 and 6, you know, have that relationship with me now, and you know, I'm a very present dad and all the rest of it, but I really got that wrong. Like, I got my career right, my personal life just blew up. Like, it wasn't great. So in all of the, like I said, we're all a little bit broken, so you do create this life for yourself, but no matter how good or soulful it is, that there's always a little cost, there's always something in it. And you know, I openly reflect that my career, this, my love, cost me personally, and you have to sort of weigh that up. And it's not easy, but ultimately it's finding the truth within that, which is that I do something that makes me happy, that I am happy with my boys, that you know, they have got two incredible mums who, you know, have fundamentally tolerated me. I mean, that's, people need an award for that at some point, because you know, I do travel a lot, life is hectic and all the rest of it. So yeah, I think it's always important to remind yourself there's two sides to every coin, isn't it? Your career is one of those, or what you do as your passion is one of those. But when you are so passionate about something and driven about something and focused on something, something has to give. So I don't in any way, shape or form think I've got it all together. I don't in any way, shape or form think I've made it. I just think that I do something that I love, and I reflect on the fact that that came at a cost too.
Would you play it differently now that you're in phase three and you're
No, I don't think I would. You know, I've got an amazing relationship with my boys. Charlie's just started Oxford Brookes studying motorsport engineering. He wants to work in Formula One, which means I get free Formula One tickets. So hello. So hook me up in the next couple of years. And Jack is, you know, I live in Edinburgh to co-parent Jack, you know, at the end of the day. Well, it's not the life I dreamt of, not that sort of, you know, the two kids under one roof with everything being idyllic. I'm happy. My boys are happy. I've got a good life. I feel soulfully connected to what I do as my purpose. And I think if I, any of that had been different, maybe this would have been different. So, you know, it's, I think it's really difficult when you go introspective or you start looking back. But no, I wouldn't change it because I wouldn't be sat here talking to you, because I wouldn't be here in Lisbon at the moment in this amazing new hotel that we've just opened. I wouldn't be surrounded by people that I care about deeply as a community. I wouldn't, you know, there's lots of things that might not have happened. So while it hasn't been ideal, I play the cards that I'm dealt. I accept what has happened, but I also appreciate where I am on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And I mean, it doesn't need to be ideal because it's yours.
Yeah. That's okay. Look, it's important. It's important you own it, right? Like at the end of the day, you know, what I hate more than anything is these platitudes that people play about their career and how everything's, it's not, dude, it's not like that at all. Like, take a breath and be honest about it. And I have always been open about my mental health, how I am at work, what life is like, what it's cost, what it's given, what I love, because that's the truth. Like, that's the truth. And I think if more leaders were honest about it and they showed integrity around that, then I think more people would go into leadership because they realize that it isn't about wearing a gilet and working at Canary Wharf. It's about being who you are. That actually is the most powerful leadership trait that any book should ever say.
Did you have examples of that kind of leadership as you were coming up?
No, I had. There's one guy, which we'll call him Mr. X. I was an AGM. So I'd left the kitchen. I'd gone beyond the path. I'd done the ultimate treacherous thing as a chef and become a waiter. I mean, horrific. I know. Let's not talk about it. If people are going to start hanging up the podcast in a minute. But, you know, because the truth of that story was that I needed more people. I needed to feel connected deeply and more than just the brothers and sisters behind the path. Like, I used to joke as a general manager, the safest place I ever had in my hotel was my kitchen. Like, if I was most stressed out, I would definitely go and eat a steak in chef's office, and it would smell sweaty and it'd be grim and all my suits would be greasy. But oh my God, I'm so happy. Anyway, so I was an AGM of this hotel, and my GM, Mr. X, was horrific. It was a really, 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 really horrible human being, actually. And I'd come back from holiday to see him shouting at the reception team in front of guests. And it was then that I knew that I was ready to be a general manager, because I was better than that and better than him. And I got a lot wrong as an early leader. Like, ego played a big part in some of my mistakes, because the purpose of the conversation, you get the bunch of keys and you become the general manager. And, you know, those early ones, and my ego got bruised a lot. It's very humbling. Like, you know, you do get a lot wrong. The early beliefs as a young leader is that you're right, but you're not. Let's stop there straight away. You know, now, if I flip from that young man then to this middle age, yeah, let's go with middle age. Don't laugh at that. Middle age, my third phase man that I am today. Today I have surrounded myself with people that are more intelligent than I am, that are better than I am, that are masters of their skill. And I go to them for advice. That is how this works in my business. Whereas then I was the Buddha on the mountain. I didn't know anything about revenue management. I was a chef. I mean, but I would, why? What is going on? You know, like, at the end of the day, my ego, this fascination to be right, the fascination that as the boss, you should know everything, when really you should know nothing. And you should actually know the questions to ask. Ask the right questions as a leader is more powerful than knowing all the answers. So my ego got battered because a really good example was, I was general manager of a hotel in Mayfair, and Michelle, who was most probably one of the best revenue managers I've ever worked with in my life. I'd matured a bit by then. You know, I was in my 40s by this point. And there was still a little bit of ego knocking around. I was a GM of a hotel in Mayfair. Like, it was every young man's dream was, now I'm running this London hotel. I had the really nice suit. I had the vibe going on. It was all happening. We would do drinks in Mayfair. You know, it's just, it was wonderful. And I used to joke all the time with her. And, you know, we would set these competitions about who was always right. And of course, I never won any of them. Not one of them. Like, it was terrifying. But it had become, for me then, it had become a joke. It had become this thing where, you know, I know better than you. Let me do this. And she's like, okay, you want to do that. I'm going to do this to see which one works. It always worked. It was always her. So, yeah, I think the best ego battering that I got was the move from the desire and need to be right. The desire that you knew everything. This ability that, because, you know, I was an AGM on Friday and I'm a GM on Monday. Zero has changed, not even my pay, if I'm honest with you. You know, zero had genuinely changed, but all of a sudden I felt like I knew it all because I'd become this thing. I'd become the antithesis of what I've been aiming for. So yeah, that, I think that's the best example that I've got, which is that you have to put your ego down a little bit, because it's not about that. Now, I just know really good questions.
Yeah. And I mean, you can be validated by the system, but what you have to pay attention to is yourself in relationship to other people.
Yeah, 100%.
How did your relationship to your own mental health change as your career started getting bigger and bigger?
Look, I'm obviously Generation X, the work hard, play hard generation. You know, when I wasn't raving on a Saturday as a chef, I was working. And then and that work hard, play hard sort of carried through. I refer to my generation as the last free range generation, right? We were the last ones that we didn't have mobile phones, didn't have any of that sort of stuff. So
privacy to get fucked up.
Hell yeah. There's not many pictures of that time. There's about three. There's about three, and I've got all of them and the negatives. So I confiscated them from a friend of mine, Jade. So they're amazing. But let's talk honestly about that period, first of all, which is that, what discussions were there about mental health in 1989, 1990, 1991, 1992? You know, mental health consisted of, you could dance out on the dance floor listening to some quite aggressive techno and then get yourself back together. I mean, Sunday was a blur. By Monday, you were most probably only seeing one of your friends. Everything was back into some sort of level of focus. So it's hard to describe my mental health at that time because I was too busy chasing joy. And even when I think about me as that early 90s raver, what was I looking for at that time was the same community that I found myself part of, this fringe, edgy community rebelling against the criminal justice bill, rebelling against all of this, the politics that sat around our nation at the time. But I found this community on the dance floor that I'd only ever experienced behind the past. So you have to remember that your ecosystem, my ecosystem at that time, not having TikTok to tell me that I was mentally ill, was surrounding myself with people that were genuinely wonderful human beings. And we had up days and down days. You had good days and bad days. And you didn't label it as mental health. You just labeled it as you're having a shit day. But when I had a shit day, everywhere I looked, there were people that cared, because I cared and they cared. So it's hard. I think as I got into leadership, as my first marriage broke down, as I started to get more and more, I don't even like calling it success. I stopped myself then because I don't like the term. As I grew in my career, I don't think it is a success. I think it's just, I do something that I love to do. It just is. So as I grew in my career, obviously taking me away from home, first marriage breaks down, still growing. It's here I start to recognize that something's not right. Like, I'm not as happy as I should be at times. You know, that I stopped dancing because, you know, suddenly I'm in a suit running a hotel in Mayfair. I stopped that ecosystem. As you grow through an organization, you know, everyone draws like a really wanky pyramid. And as you grow through the organization, well, look at an org chart. You're either in the community or you're that lonely sausage at the top. And it does get lonelier because you're not surrounded by the community anymore. You're not in a community that cares and loves you. as much as you were, you still have connections to that because the people that you grew up with are growing into roles as well. But they're over there. They're too busy now. They're doing their job. I'm doing my job. Everyone's doing their thing. So I started to notice it as I, you know, general manager was the first point. And then obviously with IHG, I moved into some really a really lovely role, like head of boutique for Europe, Russia and Israel. Like what beautiful job. Like, you know, Hotel Indigo, we moved Kimpton over from America, had this cute little hotel called the QO in Amsterdam as well that we were playing with. And all that was amazing. But as you're growing, it's you, isn't it? And as I started traveling more, it's you traveling. Like, you know, I still travel a lot. It's me on a flight. It's not a community on the flight. And I started to realize then that, you know, I needed to talk to someone. I needed to be open about how I was feeling. And I was feeling lonely. And I wasn't feeling, why wasn't I feeling happy anymore when I was doing the job as a boy, except the air steward bit, as a boy, I dreamt of. So why didn't I feel that happy anymore? Why did everything feel a bit blunted? Why wasn't I enjoying it as much? And it was in that I found therapy so useful. And I'm Jonathan, my therapist. We still every Monday 2 till 3. All my team know I'm in therapy at that time. Like, you know, I don't hide it. And you know, they leave me alone. In fairness, my EA Ellie, she'll always send me a little note afterwards, seeing how it's gone and if I need a bit of time. And she always blocked out time afterwards. Yeah, I know. It's beautiful. But that's because I'm honest about it. I think as leaders, you're sort of bred into this facade that you have to know it all, that you have to be bulletproof and resilient, and people look to you for this sort of inspiration. But that's not how you inspire people. You inspire people by being honest. So, yeah, I started to know I needed it. And then, you know, he helped me understand some of the problems I was facing. He helped me understand a diagnosis that I had. He helped me understand how to deal with it. But most of all, helped me understand to talk positively about the experience and help other people talk positively about the experience, because I have a role, particularly in our industry, to do that. Because all too often it's seen as success and success orientated. But success isn't linear. Your mental health isn't linear. Life isn't linear. You know, you can have an amazing career and a really screwed up personal life, and that is true. You can have a really amazing personal life and a really screwed up career. That is also true. You can have both that are great or both that are shit. That is also true. And that's okay. Accepting, knowing, and talking about it, for me, is my superpower.
Now when you're interacting, I mean, you interact with so many different people in so many different roles, sort of in that pyramid that you described. What sort of surprises you the most about where we are now versus when you were coming up? Like, do you think that things have changed as much as we all pretend that they have?
Yeah, considering the rave analogy, that was a really weird question. So when I was coming up, I thought lots of things, but I think.
Listen, from one ex-rec-head to another.
Let's try and work through that. I think there's a bit more respect for the hours people work and the jobs that they do. Mm. I worry not many people see it such as a career as I did at the time. I think there's still this sort of, there's a more transient nature to our industry at the moment. I think there's better support process. You know, I think even just like you guys, obviously Kelly's Claw's incredible. You know, the Burnt Chef Project, incredible. Stuff that just wasn't there. So stuff that we needed that wasn't there. So we've got better support. We've got better understanding. We've got this sort of wicked, equally as good as terrible social media presence. I hope that there's more support for people out there. And I certainly, you know, Eden was created to create, let's do that, a business that was based around the human, based around it being soulful. And I still believe in that. To this day, I still believe in that. And whether that's how Eden stays over the next 10 years, who knows? But I think even the fact there is an Eden, there wasn't, you know, that wasn't an option. Mm. You know, I remember, you know, horrific things. I remember the hours that we worked. I mean, you know, I'm as tall as I am now, and I've got a picture, which I think I showed you last time. Well, I'll send you a picture of it. It's me outside Langer's Brasserie. And I worked on source there. And I'm weighing in at like 8.5 stone. And seeing nothing wrong with that, because yeah, it was on. Let's go. Let's get it done. So, yeah, you know, I hope I hope that because there's places like Eden, because the Burnt Chef Project, because of Kelly's Cause, because of all this amazing stuff that's out there, people feel more supported. But it is still lonely. It is still difficult, particularly if your mental health isn't great, particularly if you're, you know, because saying that is that's a huge issue, particularly for chefs, or particularly for leaders, or particularly, you know, I don't think it's a gender specific thing. I think, you know, that we're ego led, a lot of us in the industry, because, you know, the food that we cook, the skills that we prepare it with, the love that we have, our knowledge of wines, whichever you want to pick, whichever your speciality is, still a bit of ego in there, right? And openly letting that guard down to accept it, which took me a bit of time.
Yeah,
it's hard.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was having a conversation with a chef recently, and we were talking about how, because so often in the industry, you're not compensated very well in terms of power or money. Like, you can be very quote unquote successful in terms of optics, but not be getting paid very well. And somebody can come along and be like, I actually don't like orange wine, change the list, you know, even though you're like, what the fuck? I'm so good at this, you know? So there's sort of this price that you pay, and what you get, the reward is ego.
Yeah.
Is that you can look around and be like, I'm fucking amazing at this. And so when ego has been the thing that you're using to validate the long hours, the sacrifices you're making, the way your personal life may or may not be suitable, maybe your substance misuse, all of that, it's a hard thing to let go of because it's become sort of a pillar of your identity.
It doesn't become a pillar of your identity. It becomes your identity. That ego takes over. You know, I weaponize my ego now in a positive way. Like, at the end of the day, I know what it is. I know what it plays for. And actually, my ego finds joy in humility, conversations like this, openness, being honest about it. And actually, I get more from that now than a service. You know, it gives you the same sort of, I'll leave this call feeling energized and oh, well, you know, I've got a couple of meetings after this. They're well in for it because, you know, I'm going to be coming at it 100 miles an hour because because my ego now finds solace and joy in this, in sharing and being honest. And
well, it's connection,
open.
Right? Yeah. Which is the
community,
which is the antidote to the loneliness. Exactly. Like, when you are interacting, or not even interacting, but making decisions for your teams, and what are sort of the practices that you think about to bear in mind the lived experience and reality of those team members, even though now you're quite far from that?
Yeah, that's the bit I struggled with when I got the job. And I refer to it as being close to the till, is how I think about it in my mind. And, you know, for my direct team, so they're known as the OLT, the Operation Leadership Team, which are their heads of operation, central ops, like, you know, the strategic level. My first year as chief operating officer was really shit for them, because I still wanted to do their job. I desperately still wanted to do their job. And I was like, I'm really lucky. If I think of the three operators, like Oscar, Ellie, and Jamie, I know I was annoying. When I was in their job, I still wanted to be doing the GM's job, because I didn't want to get that far away from it. And every step I took progressively up in my career was a shuffle away from the till. And it's taken me most probably 2 years to really understand I can add so much more value now. Like, I can change stuff. Like, I can really make a difference. When I yearned for the closeness to the operation, I yearned for the inability to sleep after a really amazing service. I yearned for the stress of a water leak so we could fix it. I yearned to look after someone's wedding. Think about what we did in hotels, particularly, you know, when I was a GM, or, you know, you sold sleep and made memories. Like, my best way of describing a hotel team's job is, and here I am in Lisbon with a brand new team here, and the story I told them was that your success is when Janet and James, God, why J's today? I did John earlier on. It's a bizarre thing. It's all the J's today. When they go home and they say, we had an amazing time in Lisbon, we had Pasta Donadas, we rolled on a yellow cable car, we battered around the city, and we met, and they named the team. Because when the team and the hotel become a seamless part of them describing Lisbon, that's it. That's 100% the sweet spot. That is experiential service delivered to its very best, because the guest cannot differentiate from being in a local bakery and eating that warm, beautiful, creamy, custardy, flaky pastry to the interaction they've had with you. And that is us. That is us at perfection, total perfection. And I remember when, you know, when we had a lot of London sites, and it was always like, I want them to mention their ride on the London Eye next to the meeting they had with you, the check-in they had with you, the conversation they had with you about how to do stuff. So I think I always, so I made Oscar's life hell, Ellie's life hell, Jamie's life hell, because I always wanted to be a head of operations. When I was a head of operations, I made my GM's life hell, because I always wanted to be the GM. And actually what I've learned is that story I've just told you, which is actually now I can create service experiences at a brand level that mean, like if I think of Eden, every market we're in, we're top quartile for service and market leading by brand. And we've got very, very few service standards. We've got a framework the team work towards, but you know, it's all based around bring your true self to work. It's simple, almost flippant throwaway remarks. But what is inside of that is this ability for the team member. A good example is one of my biggest things that I hate more than life itself at times is when I arrive at a hotel and the reception team ask if I'm checking in. Like, it actually makes my eye twitch. Like, there's almost a moment where I hold my breath, wondering how sarcastic I'm going to be about, no, I'm here to decorate the building with my suitcase. You know, there's a level inside of me that genuinely wants to say it. So in our company, if you say that, you fail your brand audit. You're done. That's it. The hotel's failed. There's no more. So you now have to create a moment. The team member.
What do you say? Well, what do you say?
Yo, I'm about to ask you that. Don't you do that. I'm about to ask you the same question. So think about this then. So you're not allowed to say that as a guest comes up to the desk.
Okay.
So what are you saying to the guest? What are you doing?
How are you?
Why isn't that nicer? Isn't that already nicer? So I now have the
that
ability.
Is nicer. So, should I come work at your hotel if it all falls apart here?
Come on, let's go. But isn't so now? I get so much love out of that. So I have to appreciate now that I am further away from the till, but I can now shape things that make the team's role feel better. That makes the guest experience. We sell memories. We create them. That's what we do. So, yeah, while I yearn to be closer to the till because I yearn the sweaty service, I realize my value now is this. So that little example of that if you say you're checking in, you fail your brand audit. Obviously, everyone did the same that you just did, which is what are we saying then? It's like, well, figure it out. Like, I don't care, but you ain't saying that. So, and you cannot say it in a different language. You just cannot say it. And it's weirdly confronting because everyone starts freaking out. Oh my God, what can I say? Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. But then you realize, actually, it's awesome because now every guest you greet differently. And why do you have to stand behind the desk when you say it? Why don't you come around and say hello as they walk in the door? Suddenly, all of the freedom that's given because you've taken away this shitty expectation from the industry. Are you checking in? No. What do you think I'm here for? Like, genuinely. So you've got to find beauty in things like that and realizing that while I caused Oscar, Jamie and Ellie a lot of hassle because I wanted to be closer to the till, and you know, they told me that a lot, a real lot, actually. They mostly told it to me this week as well. But that forced me into this thinking. So yeah, I think that's where I found it.
I think that's also so lovely because it's like, I mean, I used to say that to my team where I'd be like, if you're having a hard time tonight in service or you're struggling with your tables, just pretend that you really, 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 really care about their meal. Just really fake it.
Yeah.
And you will, by pretending to give a shit, really give a shit about that lady with the glasses who's been like a total asshole to you for an hour, you will get there and you'll feel that connection. And again, it's like that fight against loneliness. And I think when this industry is at its best, it's because you are allowed to connect with people and you're allowed to play a pivotal role in their sense of connection. You know, people are traveling, they're stressed, they're lonely. Maybe they're there for a wedding and they have to see their third cousin they hate. Like, it's a whole drama, you know?
Yeah.
And if you can be a point where they're like, oh, thank you, you know, and you can make them feel that way, you're actually like, helping someone's mental health, truly,
100%.
Right?
Well, think of it for us as well. Remember, we're apartments, right? So, you know, I'm sat in one now. I've got a lovely kitchen here. And, you know, we have people come and stay with us for a month. And, you know, think about yourself. Think about the first time you moved to a new city. That's horrifically lonely. Horrific. Even if you're moving with a partner, because 9 times out of 10, you don't really like them. So, you know, you're in this new city with a partner that's most probably encouraged you to move to the new city. That's lonely. Or you're starting your job at some bank and they've put you up in an apartment, and like interactions with us could be the most soulful part of your day, the kindest part of your day. So, you know, we haven't only got the guest that's here for one night, which our job is to make sure they have the best experience, the best meal. They literally, you know, my description of lifestyle hotels is they are trying on our lifestyle. Guests come here to try on our shoes. We have chosen the playlist. We are doing the restaurant recommendation. We are choosing the bar recommendation. Like this guest is here to put our shoes on for a night. So it's a very different experience than when you come and stay with us for a month, which is we're stewarding you. We're here to care. What do you need? Here's your 37th Amazon parcel of the day. You know, all of that sort of stuff, right? So yeah, you know, that's the difference with Eden is it's the long stay, short stay sort of hybrid model that comes with us as well.
It does make you care in a different way.
Yeah. Well, you build relationships, don't you? You know, if you and I speaking once a month is very different to you and I speaking every single day.
In all of this, you're like keeping your hotels healthy. You're keeping your teams healthy. You're like, I want to say obsessing about connection, but I mean that in like the most complimentary way possible. How are you keeping yourself mentally healthy? You mentioned therapy. Is there anything else that you...
Obviously, Jonathan every week, which is good. I'm also blessed. I've got Mike, who is a business coach for me. So he's the one helping me grow into my chief operating officer's job and whatever my future aspirations will be. So, you know, I've got two people that line check me all the time. I'm lucky. I've got a team that I'm surrounded by that want good and do good. And like any, what I hate more than the checking in thing is people that refer to teams as families. That really pisses me off. Like that's a level of triggering that is so much. Like, have you met my family? Like, seriously, let's not talk about that. So that's why I'm in therapy. No, I'm joking. That was a little side joke, just in case mom ever listens to this. But sorry, mom. Sorry, dad. Like, I do love you. So, you know, I think it's who you surround yourself with. I think vulnerability encourages the best out of people. And a leader being vulnerable means their team will feel a duty of care and responsibility around that. And I've got amazing kids. Like, genuinely, I've got Jack. It's my weekend with Jack this weekend. Jacko. You know, what are we going to be doing? I don't know. But it's going to be wicked. And I'm going to love it. I've got an amazing dog called Tilly. 56 kilos of Rhodesian Ridgeback, who is the most loving, caring thing ever. And you know, I find a lot of soul in that. I find a lot of soul in, funnily enough, I was talking to one of my team today, but we both got dogs and all the rest of it. And we both talked about how one of the most soulful things at a weekend is go for a walk in the rain, like genuinely that. I listen to a lot of podcasts and audiobooks. I spend a lot of time keeping fit. You know, a lot of my frustration comes out through pain, which is I punish myself.
Yeah, you started as a chef. Like, say something that surprises me.
Yeah, I'm covered in tattoos. Started as a chef and yeah. I like pain. I mean, welcome to the stereotype. But, you know, it's...
I was a bad, bad boy before I joined the kitchen army.
Yeah, and then it just got worse. So, so yeah, you know, I like endurance sports. So I like stuff that hurts for a long time. Like, and I find real... It sounds mental, but I find the comfort in that. Like, you know, an hour on a bike before a workout. It's good, like that sweat that it gives you. And sometimes it's to music, sometimes it's not. And I'm the ones that aren't to music seem to go the quickest because there's something on my head. I don't know what it is, but there's something in there that I need to get out. So, you know, you've got to find all your places and surround yourself with good people. I've got an amazing friendship base. Yeah, it's just finding that.
Connection with your body, your animals, your kids, your friends.
Yeah, it's all about that, right? And work. Yeah. Like, don't forget, like, if you have built the team correctly, your close team, obviously it dissipates as you get further away from your closeness as a team member. But if you've built your close team correctly and they're your people and you're their people, then it is symbiotic. Like, a good example was we did a an all hands meet. I do an all hands every year where I get all the ops leaders together. And I've been fascinated by this book called 15 Behaviors of Conscious Leadership. And three of the behaviors that I loved were radical responsibility, feeling the feelings, and owning the resolution. We did a whole day around it. We did this whole day around all of these things. And it's about living above the line, which is curious and exciting and engaging, or living below the line, which is just fundamentally fucking grumpy and don't want to get out of bed. You've got a choice every single day. And, you know, I'm not good. I'm a below the line guy sometimes. I'm an above the line guy sometimes. But over this day in this workshop, now in meetings, people call you out on it in my team. So they're like, that was a below the line comment. And you're like, yo, that was right. That was bad. Now I'm back. And that community to do stuff. Anyway, that's at this thing. They presented me with this birthday present I really wasn't expecting. And I just cried my eyes out in front of everyone. Like, I brutally broke down, because even today, I don't think I'm worth that. And that's crazy, isn't it? So it is about finding your community, not find your family or find your tribe, because that's a cliche that some wanker wrote about a gym membership. This is actually about finding people that you care about and finding people that care about you. And they don't always have to like you to care about you. That's the thing. They don't always have to agree with your decisions as a leader, but actually being part of that community. And, you know, it broke my heart when they gave me this present, and a couple of cards signed by everyone. And, you know, I just cried in front of them all. And I was like, that's okay. That's okay. That's okay to do that. And I was deeply touched by something that, you know, most people would just have been, oh, thanks for the present. But it was more than that for me, because it was from people that mattered to me.
The fact that your team is all getting to like learn this and approach things in this different way and try things and fail and connect, and what a beautiful way to do business and what a beautiful way to live. And I just can't thank you enough for sitting down.
Oh, don't be silly. Pleasure. Real pleasure.
Listen, honestly, before you go, we're going to do a little bit of quick fire. Are you ready? First thing that comes to mind. What is your go-to meal when you need some comfort?
A roast leg of lamb on a barbecue, pea and mint risotto.
Who is your celebrity crush?
Rosie Huntington Whiteley.
What's the best restaurant you've eaten at so far this year?
The Mary Celeste in Paris.
What is your favorite city in the UK?
Edinburgh.
Who is your hospitality hero? It can be somebody you've worked with, somebody you've watched from afar, but somebody who you're like, fuck yeah.
I tell you, the person that really blew my socks off when I met them was Marcus Waring. Like, just, he's the chef, right? Like, genuinely. And I'd had dinner in his restaurant, and then he came out. There was him and Theo Randall, and Theo's got a restaurant in Park Lane. And like, meeting them, I felt like I'd met something so special. Like, Theo was out, and I weirdly ended up doing a restaurant with Theo later on. And I'm still humbled the fact that I got to meet him. I'm still humbled that I ate his food. I'm still, because actually what the two of them have in common is that they're not the ego. They're not the ego. Like, I wish I'd met Marco during the White Heat era. Like, that's the guy. Mm-hmm. I've met Marco a few times. And funnily enough, in IHG, we had a few restaurants with him as well. But I want, if I could have met anyone, he would have been the one at that time. The time when he got the three Michelin stars and he said, why the fuck would I have taken these three Michelin stars from you when I know more about cookery than you do? Like, I wanted to be in that room when that happened, because that is iconic to the next level, which is, who are you to judge me? Like, I cook better than you cook. Like, that even gives me hairs on the back of my neck. So yeah, Marcus and Theo, because I genuinely believe in them as chefs, and I genuinely believe in them as people. And both times I met them, and obviously got to meet Theo a lot more as we did the restaurant together, like, that man is a genuinely lovely human being. Like, deeply, his love for Labradors also made me love him a little bit as well, which was amazing. So yeah, I think I wish I'd met Marco and White Heat, and then those two boys. Like, genuinely, just fantastic. Like, mind-blowingly fantastic.
Fab. Paul, thank you so much again for your time. You've been an absolute treat.
Oh, thanks. I've really enjoyed it. And like, you know, I do appreciate the work that you guys do as well. You know, it's really valuable work, and the industry is better for it.
Thank you.
Beyond the Path is produced by Kelly's Cause. For more information about Kelly's Cause, please head to kellyscause.com or find us on Instagram @kellyscause.